Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list, we'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Well, I hope that you're all well this week, that you've enjoyed the heat wave that is scorching us here in the UK at the moment. Last week, my travel diaries were in Cornwall. And this week takes me to one of my hidden gems in the UK, somewhere I've been on holiday numerous times. And if you're heading back London way, it's a great place to stop off, actually, on the way back from the southwest up to the city. A little more than 2 hours west of London by train, Bruton is a quiet farming town in the county of Somerset, or at least it used to be quiet. Over the last few years, creatives have discovered the hamlet and begun converting its historic estates into galleries, stylish hotels, and incredible restaurants. This time around, I stayed at one of the new openings there, Number One Bruton, an elegant Georgian townhouse, medieval forge, and row of cottages that have been beautifully converted into a 12-bedroom hotel, all set around the most cute private courtyard. At the heart of the project is a clear devotion to Somerset's craft heritage, artistry and culture. And what makes a stay there even more exciting is that within the hotel is OSIP, a tiny farm-to-table restaurant run by 25-year-old chef Merlin LeBron Johnson, which, having only been open a year, has just been awarded a Michelin star. I've eaten there a couple of times. I ate there when it first opened and obviously just now, and truly one of the most memorable meals each time that I've ever experienced, and excellent value as well. I think it was about £65 a head for a 6 or 7 course tasting menu, and yeah, truly worth the visit. World-renowned art gallery Hauser & Wirth, they have an outpost out there in Bruton along with a hip restaurant, and the town itself is now home to several design shops and artisan eateries. One of my favourites is At the Chapel, which is a stunning church conversion, and it's a great place to go to for brunch. It's a real retreat from city life, and you know, I really couldn't recommend Bruton more highly. So that's my travel tip for this week. Right, on to today's guest. I feel very privileged to be joined by another legend of the broadcasting world today. John Simpson has been reporting for the BBC for 51 years and has been its World Affairs editor since 1982, covering in person more major world events than many of us could probably recount, from the Iranian Revolution and Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing to the Kosovo War and US-led invasion of Afghanistan, interviewing the majority of the world's leaders along the way. Having broadcast from the front line in over 30 war zones, today's episode features so many tales of courage. And if you read up on John's career, really, we're just scratching the surface. We'll hear about what it was like being smuggled into Afghanistan dressed as a woman, the time he was physically assaulted by a British Prime Minister, and his extremely close shave with the IRA in Belfast. And along with those kind of stories, it's clear that John also adores travelling. And I love that he's picked really unusual destinations that, you know, weren't necessarily on my radar before. And he's totally sold me on them, and I'm sure he will you too. So from Paris to Iran, Uzbekistan to Argentina, let's get started. John Simpson, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. It is so wonderful to be speaking with you today in what looks like a beautiful room. Is that a library you're in? What's
yes,
there behind you?
Beautiful up to a point. I mean, there are nice books around, but the picture here is, let me show you, it's actually Stalin. Oh. Not many people have Stalin in their sitting room. So I usually keep it down like that in case, you know, I get...
In case it offends someone.
That's right. I get reported to the thought police or something.
I was reading that before COVID, you were traveling or, you know, catching a plane every 5 days or so, was it?
That was right. I worked that out. I got ill, and I was lying flat on my back in hospital with loads of stuff kind of sticking out of me, and I couldn't read for a bit. I wasn't able to do anything, and so I just kind of thought, and I worked out how many trips I'd done, mental memory feat beyond anything I would have thought I could possibly do. And I worked it out. Yeah, since 1970 was when I started traveling abroad for the BBC. And once every 5 days. But of course, in the last, what is it, 18, 19 months, absolutely zero. I haven't been on a plane since I went, I think, to Beirut in February of last year, 2020. So, the average is probably like my granny's average now.
But I mean, a complete change of pace of life for you to have that kind of energy, the freneticness of changing environments all the time. Are you looking forward to getting back on a plane and getting back to that?
I really, really am. Actually, I've kept a kind of control over it because, I thought otherwise I'd be bouncing off the walls. So I've just enjoyed being locked down, enjoyed my wife's company, enjoyed very much the company of my 15-year-old son, who I probably wouldn't have seen much of over the last year otherwise. I even enjoyed the dog's company, and I just kind of kept it quiet. But now I'm very shortly at the end of, at about the 23rd, 24th of August, going to go to Afghanistan, which all seems to be falling apart. And, I can't help but be really excited by that. I mean, that's, the kind of thing that I absolutely love to cover. I don't mean to say I love, other people's misery, but I mean, it'll be very exciting and very difficult, I think.
How do you think you'll feel having been away from the front line to get back as your first place, Afghanistan? I mean, I know you've spent a huge amount of time there, but you're really going right back to the thick of it.
Yeah, well, I really do know Kabul. I mean, I must have spent about 2 or 3 years in Afghanistan out of my life. Mm-hmm. I know it. I've got loads of friends there, many of whom, of course, are trying to get out of it at the moment. And I'll just slot back in. Mm-hmm. Within about 5 minutes, I expect.
Amazing. And I was looking at the sheer volume of countries that you visited. It's an awful lot, isn't it? I mean, we're in the hundreds, right?
Yeah, I think it must be. I think it's more than 150. But those are countries that I broadcast from. I must have been to others that I haven't broadcast from. So, but that's, 152, I think it is, something like that.
So although we're about to embark on the 7 chapters of your life's travel diaries, this just amounts to part one of a multitude of volumes, right? So let's get started with chapter 1, which is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
Well, childhood, actually not much. I mean, my first memory of a journey was not a very good one, really. My poor mother weeping away and saying to me that my father was impossible and she couldn't live with him anymore. And I was about two, I think, and taking me to Epsom. So it wasn't exactly a sort of, macro journey. And in those days, I mean, that was in the 40s. In the 50s, only really rich people did much traveling. But my father, because I eventually settled down, lived with my father, just the two of us, he had been a great traveler. I mean, he ran away to sea when he was, I think, 15 or 16. He was impossible, like my mum said, but he nevertheless was a wonderfully traveled person. He became a steward on a P&O shipping line. And
so
he went right around the world, I don't know, 8 or 9 times or something like that. So he used to say, oh God, this country is so bloody provincial. And during the really bad winter of 1962-3, when everything froze up, especially our water pipes and toilets and everything, because we lived on in a weird, vast, awful, ugly house on the clifftop in Dunwich in Suffolk. It all froze, and my father said, "I can't bear this anymore." And although we didn't have any money much, he said, "We're going to Casablanca." I think he'd never been there, and I think he liked the idea of the film.
Yes, I mean, even the name sounds so exotic.
Yes. So I was 18, I suppose. Yeah, 18 at the time, and we got an Air France flight from Heathrow to Paris, and we then got onto a rickety propeller-driven plane of Royal Maroc Airlines and flew to Casablanca, which was an absolute delight and an eye-opener, and all sorts of exciting things happened to us. And anyway, so that was my first real proper journey.
And what was your impression of Casablanca when you landed there? I mean, I've never been to Casablanca. I've been to Morocco. But I mean, getting off that plane, and as we said, like, the name conjured such an exotic vision. What was it like? How did it feel?
Well, I'd never, of course, been really properly outside the UK before, so it really was quite a shock. I mean, the sad thing was that Casablanca then, and I think now, is a fairly crap industrial city, but nevertheless, I mean, there were really exciting, interesting old parts of it. And just to lie there on my bed with a mosquito net and a fan, ceiling fan, just seemed, I mean, I just thought I was Somerset Maugham or Graham Greene or something at the age of 18. I was so excited to be there. There was a wonderful smell, not always a very beautiful one, but there was a wonderful smell. And we went to crazy places, interesting local, you know, local Moroccan places, Arab restaurants. My father loved all that kind of stuff.
And did your dad, I mean, you know, you said how well traveled he is. I mean, was it him who instilled in you this desire to go out and travel? Because I read that you said that it was really the thought of traveling that attracted you to journalism as well.
In many ways it was. I mean, I loved writing. I still do. I get a huge pleasure from just simply the act of sitting at a laptop and bashing out stuff. It never ceases to be an attraction. But the idea of traveling, I suppose also I took this idea of my father's on board. Britain is insular. Nobody here knows anything about the outside world. Therefore, you've got to get out and discover the outside world, which I did and have done to a certain extent. So I suppose it was that. It was him kind of pushing, but also the absolute joy of writing about what I was doing.
And we'll come on to your writing later, because I've been really enjoying your latest offering.
Thank you.
First of all, though, you became a BBC reporter back in, as you said, 1970. And one of your first days was quite a memorable one, would you say?
Yes, my very first day out. The newspapers were full of those sort of nudge-nudge kind of political articles, which I came to loathe so much, suggesting that Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister of the time, was considering holding a general election, snap election. And I was entirely new. It really was my first, maybe my second day as a reporter. And my boss, the head of news, was also brand new to British reporting. He'd been working for the overseas service. And so he didn't know any better. I didn't know any better. And he said to me, look, there's nobody else here. They're all doing other stories. Newspapers are full of suggestions that Harold Wilson's going to call an election. We've been told he's doing a photo call at 11 o'clock at Euston Station in London, Platform 7. I could take you to the very place where it happened. Why don't you ask him if he's going to hold an election? So I thought, well, this is not bad. My first day. And I turned up characteristically a bit late. Must have been, I don't know, 150 people or something jammed onto the platform. And I got there late. There was no place for me to stand. So I had to stand in front of everybody. You know, move away, Sonny. Come on. You're not made of glass, you know, all that sort of stuff. And along comes Harold Wilson with all his sort of hangers-on. And I look round and nobody's going to say anything. They're all smiling at him and saying morning, Prime Minister, and all that kind of creepy stuff that that journalists often do. And I thought, well, in that case, if nobody else is going to ask him, I'm going to ask him. So I stepped up and I said to him, held out the microphone, excuse me, Prime Minister, but your newspapers are full of chat about an election. Is it true? Are you going to call an election? Except I didn't quite get as far as that. I got as far as, excuse me, Prime, when Harold Wilson, who was actually quite a kind of mild-mannered kind of bloke normally, absolutely exploded with rage and walloped me really hard with his left fist right in my stomach and doubled me up and tried to get the microphone out of my hand with his other hand. And he said, you know, I never do these things. The BBC knows that I never do these things. I'm so angry about this. Directly I get to Liverpool, I'll be on the phone to your director general to put in the strongest complaint possible about your appalling behaviour. And then he got on the train. God. And all the journalists, cameramen, everybody laughing, you can't do that. I remember one of them said, you don't ask the Prime Minister questions, Sonny. And I thought, why don't you ask the Prime Minister questions? But anyway, I was too busy kind of coughing and retching. It was 10 to 11 on my first day, and I had been physically assaulted by the Prime Minister in front of the world's press, and I'd lost my job. But actually, on the train journey, I suppose Harold Wilson, who wasn't a bad bloke, I got to know him afterwards. I suppose he must have thought, oh, well, what the hell, you know, it's not worth making a fuss about. So I kept my job. But the story of Wilson attacking a reporter didn't appear anywhere. Well, not that I know.
I mean, how times have changed, because imagine if that was to happen now.
Yes, can you imagine now?
But your first taste, though, of really being like on the journalistic front line, a different kind of front line. But I mean, how did that make you feel? Was it a buzz? Did you find that exciting?
No, I was terribly scared. I was nearly, I was captured by the Provisional IRA on my first outing in Northern Ireland. I was so stupid. I turned up dressed dressed like an off-duty British Army officer would, in a sports jacket and dark trousers and brogues and a tie. Mm-hmm. And I had my little tape recorder in my pocket, and I went to cover an IRA funeral. Anyway, one of the IRA people, there were no police, no army, of course, in the whole of the cemetery, Glasnevin Cemetery in Belfast. They spotted a Daily Mirror photographer. The IRA hated the Daily Mirror, I forget why. And they beat the bejesus out of him just nearby. I mean, so bad he had to be airlifted back to England, and I don't think he ever worked again. Gosh. And they got me, and a bloke, a really nasty-looking bloke, said, give him one up the nostril, which means put a gun like that and fire it. Wonderful, wonderful Sunday Times correspondent whom I'd walked to Glasnevin Cemetery with, thank God. So brave. He just wandered over in a very sort of relaxed way, and he said, oh, hello, John. Is there some sort of problem? He said to these people. And they said, he's a fucking army spay. And this guy, they knew because he'd done quite a lot of work about the IRA. And And he said, oh, no, you got the wrong end of the stick. Entirely works for the BBC. So then they said to me, OK, if you work for the BBC, where's your BBC ID? And, you know, I was always careless and I don't think I had a BBC ID for some reason. And that meant that they really did think that I was a spy. But Derek kind of talked them over, calmed them down. No, you know, just go, come with us now. We can go back to John's car. I'd given him a lift, thank God. And so they let me go. But I went back to my hotel. And I remember this all so clearly, and sat down on the bed, and I thought, this lark isn't for me. Really? There are tough characters in the BBC who can do this kind of stuff. But, you know, I'm sensitive. I feel pain easily. I don't think I'm going to carry on with this. And I thought, I'll call my boss and say, look, I'm sorry. I'm not the person that you thought I was, and I'd like to come home, please. But then, I don't know, I remember ordering a steak and a bottle of wine on room service, and I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll just stick it out a little bit longer, and I did. I mean, I didn't ring anybody up, and I stayed for 2-3 weeks or something, covering very quite unpleasant stories. And in the end, you know, I did carry on doing the whole thing.
That's so interesting that you should say that, because I was going to ask you, you've reported from so many war zones and put yourself in extremely dangerous situations. And I read that when most journalists were evacuating from places like Baghdad and Belgrade, you were staying behind. So I was going to ask you where your fearlessness and single-mindedness to get the story came from. So that obviously evolved. It wasn't all there at the start.
No, we're certainly not then. And I learned the hard way during the civil war in Angola, when two of us actually had a really sort of world-beating story about some British mercenaries, in fact, who had been murdered by their commanding officer. And I was very, very, very scared. And I was there with a rather crafty cameraman who worked for NBC America, and we were working together. And I said, I wonder whether, you know, we should get this story out. I mean, I should probably get on a plane. And he said, yeah, you get on the plane. I'll just hang on, you know, for a few more hours sorting out my gear and stuff like that. So he encouraged me to get on the plane. And then, of course, he got the whole of the rest of the story. And I wrote to him quite a sort of angry note afterwards. And he said to me, yeah, I know, probably, you know, I should have encouraged you to stay. Mm-hmm. But he said, let that be a lesson. He was, I don't know, 20 years older than me. Never leave a story till it's over. Mm-hmm. And I learned the lesson. You know, another hard-earned lesson,
I should say. Well, let's pause there and move on to chapter 2, the first place you fell in love with.
A very, very corny, but Paris. I didn't go to Paris until when I, in fact, became the BBC's what we then called common market correspondent. Very difficult, very tricky, awful, boring story, but incredibly important at that stage, because Britain was just joining the EU, and I'd never been to Paris. I didn't know how to get to the center of Paris. I rented a car at Charles de Gaulle Airport and drove in. But I didn't really speak much French at that stage. Now it's, thank God, one of my main languages. But I couldn't see any sign that said center of town. So it took me ages to find the center of Paris. And I was staying at a hotel on the Champs-Élysées. And I just absolutely adored it. And I didn't get in till after all this sort of driving around till about 1 in the morning or something. And the hotel Claridge, now It either closed down or it's under new management or something. And I had this little bedroom, tiny little bedroom overlooking the Champs-Élysées. And I didn't close the curtains that night because I just wanted, even from my bed, to be able to see the Champs-Élysées. And the tinier little bathroom, well, just a shower room and a loo, really, and a white toweling bathrobe. And I thought, I've never seen anything so sophisticated in my life. I just absolutely adored the place, and always have ever since. And I lived there for a while, had a flat there in the 7th, and had a great time.
And you lived there and returned so many times. What are your favorite Parisian haunts?
Well, I would feel that I'd never I hadn't been to Paris, even if I was in the Champs-Élysées, until I'd been to the Rue de Rivoli. And that just seems, I mean, I've got so many memories of that area, friends who lived just around the corner, restaurants I've been to, cafes I've been to, demonstrations I've covered in the Rue de Rivoli. Nearly got my head knocked off at one stage in some student riots.
Oh, God.
And I just, that to me is the absolute heart of Paris.
So is that like the quintessential Parisian experience, walking down that road, would you say?
Well, for me it is. And there's a little bar there that I've always been to, which is still pretty much unchanged, what those sort of red sort of leatherette chairs, and so many bums have sat on them, bottoms, over the decades, that it's all kind of worn away. I have a Ricard, and I think I'm back.
One of the all-time greats. So chapter 3 is the place where you learned the most about yourself. This must be a hard one. I mean, there must be so many formative experiences over the decades of traveling.
I suppose the place that I really kind of got some insights into myself, not always fantastically noble ones, of course, was Baghdad. In 1990 and 1991, in the run-up to the first Gulf War, which happened in January 1991, and I stayed there for about 6 months, I think, in Baghdad, right through to the war. But I remember I came out from time to time, had to, but always went back quite quickly. As I was checking in at Amman Airport in Jordan with various other, not very many actually, Western journalists, really just a guy from CNN and somebody else from Spanish television, I think just the three of us. And we were queuing up to get on, not that there was anybody on the plane except the three of us, I think. And I got into conversation with this CNN man who was a producer. And I really, really admired him and liked him. And I said to him, what the hell are you doing going to Baghdad? And, he laughed. And he said, oh, well, I was in Saigon when it fell to the Viet Cong. Only I got out that morning with a lot of other journalists. And he said, so that was 15 years earlier or something. He said, I've spent the last 15 years trying to make up for it and never wanting to lose an opportunity to show that I wasn't chicken. And he said, so I'm going here and I'm not leaving, he said. And I thought, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I don't want to spend the rest of my life saying, oh, well, I could have stayed, but I've always stayed whenever I possibly can. I mean, sometimes they use a forklift to put you on the plane to get rid of you, but mostly you can, I've found, stay. I'll never leave a place again. And I say this, you know, just before going to Kabul, which could easily fall in the next few months. But if it does, I don't think I'll be leaving. I think I'll stay there.
How does your family cope with that? Because I know you have a young son and you've got older daughters as well. Being there for such an extended period of time when, you know, you're out in Baghdad or coming up going to Afghanistan in these precarious times, is it difficult to manage your relationships with them?
Well, they've got to be really nice people, and they are, thank goodness. And they put up with me, and they put up with my job, and they forgive me, I think. It's easier for my wife. She's a former producer, South African lady who came and worked with me at the time of Nelson Mandela's election in 1994. And so she knows, she doesn't get worried. She's been to Afghanistan herself with me, working with me. So she knows that it isn't always as frightening as it seems, you know, when you're looking, reading the papers or watching television. My son is different because he's a very sensitive kid. And when I used to go a lot to Iraq all during the civil war. Every 6 weeks, I did 2 weeks in Iraq from start to finish. And I remember in our house in Chelsea in London, he must have been about four, I think. I was leaving on one of these trips, and poor little kid, he stood at the front door with his arms out to try to stop me. And later, his school, one of his teachers said to me, "I always know when you're abroad or somewhere difficult because Rafe spends a lot of time looking out of the window." And, you know, that's not done. He's coming up to his GCSEs and so on. But, you know, that's how I earn a living, really. And there's not much I can do to stop it. I've just got to hope that he'll develop the sort of, you know, necessary toughness to put up with it.
And he must be very proud.
I don't know. I see no evidence particularly.
Well, speaking of Afghanistan, I had to ask you, after 9/11, you wanted to get into Afghanistan as the country was preparing for the American assault. So tell me what you did to get in there.
First thing, I got irritated. I'd spent quite a lot of time in Afghanistan before that. I was actually there on 9/11. The Taliban put out a statement that said if they caught any foreign journalists in their territory, they would shoot them. And that just kind of really pissed me off. And I thought, why should anybody, you know, threaten to do this? And so I thought, okay, I'm bloody well going to do it. And we worked out, I got a gang of, cross-border smugglers, and I paid them some cash to take me in. And they said, look, the only way that you're going to get through and survive the experience is if you put a burqa on, because nobody can see you under a burqa. So both I and the cameraman wore burqas to get in, and the smugglers were right. I mean, the Taliban would just look at us and look away. I mean, they weren't the slightest bit interested. I had to do something about my large size 11 boots and so on, but you could cover those in the back of the van.
What did you do?
I would just cover them with. I got them to give me some kind of I don't know, just rubbishy cloth, and we put our boots underneath it. The cameraman and I, the burqa is such a sort of billowing, fantastically large garment that the cameraman was able to have his camera, full size television camera, under it with him, and it still didn't show.
No way. So he looked like he was a very large, plump woman.
Yes, he won that. Yes, that's right. Yes, yes. No, exactly. The only bad thing about it was the little head pieces were so tight that it gave both of us really bad headaches, especially with all the fumes of the vehicle and bouncing around and everything. That was quite difficult. And then, so we did some, we stayed there for a bit, did some filming, and then came back. And I remember the cameraman who knows Afghanistan better than almost any other Westerner said to me, then nobody's ever going to forget this, you know. And I said, oh, come on, it's just another thing to do. And, but he was, I'm afraid, right. And I still get all sorts of mostly not very flattering references to it.
And I mean, did it give you an insight into the female experience there?
Absolutely did. I'll never forget what it was like. The burqa, if you can sort of summon up the memory of it, has got a sort of lace patch for the eyes,
right?
And it's thick lace eyes, hard to see through it. And the extraordinary thing was, directly you put this on, you cease to be effectively a human being. And so I remember I was halfway through giving my instructions to this gang of smugglers, telling them where we wanted to go, what we wanted them to do, and so on, as I was putting the burqa on. And directly, the instant that the burqa was over my face, they started talking to the cameraman. And when the cameraman put his burqa on, they started talking to the driver, the Afghan driver who was with us. And it was really hard to break through that and to be still wearing this thing and to give them their orders, because I'd become a woman. And women counted for absolutely zero, and their instructions, their orders meant absolutely nothing to these guys. And it was really hard to force them to do things they didn't want while kind of all covered up with the burqa. And a more horrible experience I don't think I've had in that respect. And the thought that they may be coming back and to control Afghanistan again is a miserable one.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80
and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. Next up is chapter 4, your all-time favorite destination. What comes to mind when you've visited so many places?
Well, I actually love a lot of places.
I've got a sort of heart-wrenching
sense of, a dozen places. But of course, inevitably, it's the ones you can't easily get to that I love the mm-hmm. most. And mm-hmm. I've spent over the years large amounts of time in Iran, learned the language, although it's now slipped away from what's left of my brain. I think just about everything about Iran, except its present government, but everything to do with it, with its society and the cuisine and the architecture and the tea and the fezanjoun, one of my favorite dishes, and so on.
I'm so pleased you brought up Iran, because obviously I knew that you had traveled there a lot, and it's a destination I've always been so curious about. I've heard such amazing things, and I was interested in booking a trip there not so long ago. I think it would be much harder now, but I know it's one of the most beautiful countries
absolutely.
In the world.
But it is still possible to go. It's not as... And you know, there's a new hardline president who may well change things a bit. But if you do go, two things will happen, you'll find. One is that it will be nothing like you think of when you watch all the television things, people chanting death mm-hmm. to America, death to Britain. And the other thing allied to that is that you will find how incredibly popular British people are.
This podcast is popular in Iran.
Is
I
it?
See where in the world my listens are each week. And I'm always amazed that there's a really great contingent there that listens every week in Iran.
Well, they've had their problems with Britain. Which country on earth hasn't, actually? I mean, you know, we've stuck our fingers in just about everybody's pie around the world at some stage, done some dodgy things, of course, majorly dodgy things. But ordinary people really, really are charming to Brits. I dare say they are to Americans too, but particularly to the Brits, because our history goes back so far.
And if you were a first-time visitor to Iran, where would you start off? Where would you suggest would be a good place to go first?
Well, you have to remember that Tehran, the capital, is just about the ugliest city in the entire country. So,
right,
although
okay.
there are wonderful bits of Tehran, I mean, the Grand Bazaar is a place to go and spend days in, I would say. But you have to get out. And the wonderful cities of the eastern part of the country, Mashhad and so on, near the Afghan border, or down, of course, to some of the most exciting and wonderful places, both historically and in terms of architecture or something, is Isfahan mm-hmm. is one of my top three cities in the world anywhere.
Really?
Oh, yes, absolutely lovely.
Because of its appearance, and because of its culture.
Yeah, it's wonderful architecture. I mean, absolutely stunning, mostly built in the 16th and 17th centuries. Wonderful places to go. And you just, if anybody does do this, go out on a Thursday night, Thursday late on a Thursday evening, sort of 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and wander around the parks and everything. Everywhere you will see little groups, family groups, having their evenings picnic in the parks, and you will not be able to get through it, believe me, without sitting down and joining in somebody's evening meal. And they'll
How
be
lovely.
So whether they speak English or not, you will be treated like an honored guest. And of course, not very far from Isfahan is Persepolis, which is one of the great ruined cities, archaeological sites of the world, and so much of it has remained, burned accidentally or not by Alexander the Great, but nevertheless still there and still wonderful, heart-stoppingly wonderful. Mm.
I dream of getting there one day. Thank you for bringing it to life so beautifully. Chapter 5 is your hidden gem, a place that you love that my listeners might not know so much about.
Yes, well, I've got this thing for Central Asia. That's my that's my area that really delights me when I get there. Mm-hmm. And Uzbekistan has an awful government, but it's got wonderful, wonderful cities in it. And if you can get to Bukhara, where all sorts of bad things have happened over the centuries, but the one thing that hasn't happened is that not even the Russians, who, of course, you know, it was part of the old Soviet Union, Uzbekistan, not even the Russians pulled down the best bits of it. Bukhara is, I think, the most beautiful place that I can think of.
Oh, I've been blown away by the pictures that I've seen of Uzbekistan. I don't know if I can picture Bukhara, but I picture Samarkand that I've seen a lot.
Yeah, Samarkand's nice, but Samarkand was messed up by the Soviets. Some of it still is as it was, and lovely, and it's certainly definitely worth the trip. But Bukhara, and there's another place called Khiva, Khiva, which is just magnificent. Most marvelous Mongol architecture and post-Mongol architecture. Lovely stuff.
Mm.
And nobody much goes there because it does have a rather unpleasant government, and it's hard to get in, but worth it.
Okay, noted. In contrast to that, chapter 6 is your worst ever travel experience.
Oh, God, yeah. I had problems when I knew you wanted me to ask me this, because, I mean, I've had awful, awful experiences, but somehow or another, they're mostly to do with getting to difficult places. And somehow or another, that's a part of the whole experience. So that, for instance, in Afghanistan, I came in just before the fall of the Taliban in 2001, after 9/11. I came down from the north through, I think, one of the stans. I forget which one we finally came through. And we had, I think, an 8-day journey, which was the hardest of my life.
No
roads, for instance, so we had these Russian, very sturdy Russian jeeps. I think we rented 5 of them and 2 of them survived the experience. The only way you could do these things was to drive over riverbeds with sort of rocks in them, and everything it sort of shook the fillings out of your teeth. And at one stage, there was a flange of metal that was sticking out. I mean, Russian jeeps are not built for comfort, as you can imagine. And I cut my leg on this thing, and it never healed. And eventually, I actually nearly died of sepsis as a result of the wound. I was okay in the end, but it was really dodgy. So, I mean, that was probably the worst journey of my life, except that we had a place to go to, which was just on the northern edge of Kabul. The Taliban still controlled Kabul, but we could get down to the northern edge, which was run by the pro-Western group called the Northern Alliance. So it was really kind of positive. So even though I had this big sort of mark on my leg that was bleeding away, and even though I had a headache to last me until kingdom come, and we lived on all sorts of ghastly food, nevertheless, it was wonderful to get there. So I the places that I don't like, maybe you're too nice to ask me these things. Places I don't like are the places that are easy and bland and boring, actually. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Qatar. God, you know, I mean,
I can't imagine you having a holiday in any of those places.
No, well, we mistakenly, just before the lockdown, about the week before, my wife found the only cheap place we could just hop on a plane to go to was Qatar. We had, I think, a week there or something. And, I wouldn't even go for the World Cup, let alone for that. And they, no booze anywhere, you know, they found a bottle of booze in my luggage and took it away. you know, very, very boring.
Well, your new book, Our Friends in Beijing, very exciting. It follows on from your first novel, Moscow Midnight. So tell me a bit about the book and what inspired this story of John, the journalist protagonist.
Yeah, well, in fact, it's really a story of, it's really based very heavily on fact. Of course, you can't write a novel about fact, strict fact, because, you know, you get sued apart from anything else. But I've dusted it with fiction. But something like 70 or 80% of the things that happen, including some of the quite nasty things have happened to me over the years, not necessarily in China, but mostly in China. And it's the story really about a Chinese political grandee whose name in real life was Bo Xilai, who staged a kind of coup against the Chinese authorities. And I knew Bo Xilai from way, way back in the 1990s. And I just extended that by making him my translator at the time of Tiananmen Square. But in fact, Bo Xilai wasn't my translator. But I liked him. I liked him a great deal. I could see that, you know, he wasn't quite, 14 annas to the rupee. I mean, he was dodgy. Definitely dodgy. Mm-hmm. But I did like him. And he almost staged his coup attempt. His wife was caught for murdering a British businessman. And that kind of ruined him. I didn't like his wife very much. And that ruined him by association. And he's now doing life in a prison, which I hope is not too bad. I've tried to send him things, but I don't think any of it's got through. So I based the novel on him and his coup attempt. And there's a character that's kind of like me in it, only with lots of differences, but, sort of moderately recognizable.
You must have had fun turning all these momentous experiences that you've had throughout the years into, you know, a page turner.
Yes, well, thank you. Yes, but the most enjoyment, you know, ever since about 2013, I've had real difficulties at the BBC. They've ended now, thank God, the whole thing's finished. But we brought in a head of news from the Times newspaper. He was the editor of the Times, and he came in on a mission to get rid of all the old characters like me. So John Humphreys and Jeremy Paxman, David Dimbleby and all these people. He didn't tell anybody that he was on a mission to do it. Well, I think he did tell one or two people close to him, but he didn't obviously make it known. And I had a real, real battle just clinging onto the cliff face to stop them chucking me out. And they cut my pay in half, and then they threatened to cut it again by another half in order to sort of drive me out. And what nicer way, what better way to get your own back than to put some version of the character, only without the nice or clever sides, of course, of this man, who is actually both nice and clever in many, many ways. But, you know, you wouldn't think that, I think, from my novel. And I just... I just had the greatest fun in doing that and making fun of him, making fun of the way he spoke and acted and all of this.
That's brilliant. Well, finally, we're on to chapter 7, and that is the destination at the top of your travel bucket list.
Well, I mean, aside from places that I can't easily get to, like Iran. I've been to most places that I want to go to and like. So we're now looking at, you know, what other places are there that I love, don't get to enough, and would adore to go back to. Mm-hmm. And that, I suppose, is Argentina. I just absolutely adore everything about Argentina. I love the style. I love the language. I mean, the Argentine Spanish is just delightful to my ear. Of course, who couldn't like the steaks? Well, I suppose you wouldn't if you were a vegetarian, but I'm not yet, although I have been in the past. And I love the music, the bandoneons, the dancing, you know, the way that I also love that attitude of Argentinians, that, you know, the world, and particularly sadly their own country, is going down the tube as we watch, and yet they always make it delightful and charming and light in touch, and nobody gets too serious about it. And I mean, the thing that I suppose I love the most is going out. I took my wife there fairly recently. It was the first time she'd been there, and she was getting nervous about our evening meal, because she thought I was being far too sort of offhand about it. And when it got to be 10:30 and we still hadn't set foot out of our hotel room to go and get a meal, she said, look, we can't wait around any longer. And when we got into the restaurant, it was empty. And she said, you see, and I called a waiter over and I said, when do you think people will be coming in? And he said, in an hour or something like that.
Such a different way of life, isn't it?
Oh, it's wonderful. So little kids coming in, and it was just lovely. Families all around us in this very, not expensive restaurant, but very, very good restaurant. And then, you know, so we finished our meal at about, 2 o'clock, 1:30 or 2 o'clock. And I thought, why don't we go and see a movie? So we went into the perhaps 3 o'clock in the morning showing, packed out.
At 3 o'clock?
And we came out at about 5 o'clock, 5:30, whatever it was. And I said to Dee, to my wife, that was such a great film. You know, and it was based on a novel by one of my favorite Argentine writers, Borges. I said, why don't we just go and get a copy of it? I'd like to get it. So we went into a bookshop 5:30 in the morning and bought a copy of the book, and then came back to our hotel and lay down and had breakfast later. And I just think the Argentines have the art of living perfectly. Mm. So that's, it's not, it's, again, I've written a book about Argentina. It's not that I don't know it and would be excited to go there, but knowing it, I am, you know, always excited to go back.
Oh,
and that would be my absolute number one destination, Buenos Aires.
Perfect. Oh, thank you so much, John Simpson. Those were your travel diaries. It has been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Very nice of you and lovely questions.
Oh, I could have talked to John for hours more. What a lovely man and what an incredible privilege to hear some of his travel diaries. His novel, Our Friends in Beijing, is published by John Murray and is out on Thursday, July 22nd. And thank you so much for listening today. If you've enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss an episode. It's really easy to do that. On Apple, they've just changed it so that you follow rather than subscribe by pressing the plus sign in the top right-hand corner of the app. I would also be so grateful if you could leave a rating or a review. It really helps other people to discover the podcast. To find out who's joining me next week, follow me on Instagram at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you. And if you can't wait until then, there's all of seasons 1, 2, 3, and 4 to catch up on. Thanks again. Take care, and I'll be back with you next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.